After he kills him, he's like, did not know who he was fucking with. I just...
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
Where the hell can I get eyes like that?
Gotta kill a few people.
Okay, I can do it.
Then you gotta get sent to a slam where they tell you you'll never see daylight again. You dig up a doctor, and you pay him 20 menthol cools to do a surgical shine job.
Hello, everybody. On a Monday, this is Wreckatopia episode 135. Today's big recommend is Pitch Black. David Toohey. I had to look that up. I had always called it Twohee, called his name Twohee, because I didn't think, no, he doesn't use two as his pronunciation. Anyway, I had to look that up. Anyway, David Toohey's 2000 movie, Pitch Black. As we continue, I believe we're doing some horror over the October month, and this was a surprise one from Aaron, I've got to say. I'm very happy to be talking about it, though. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Venerinos.
That's right, Venerinos. And welcome, chat. And I see Jets Mets is talking about the playoffs, and I can tell you this, Jets Mets, you have a team that is never out of it, and that's why you just enjoy the ride. That is that's one of those things, and I hope they beat the Phillies too. So anyway, you got a friend in me on that one. All right, Aaron, do you want to start us off on our small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Sure. I want to talk about a movie called Defiance. I'm not sure if this has ever come up on the show before, but this is Daniel Craig in a movie that follows based on a true story of some Jewish brothers when the Nazis were invading Belarus, I think, and how they kind of formed this community in the woods, and many Jewish people, you know, came in there, and the challenges they went through finding food, and also how, you know, where is your line on violence? Do you attack the Nazis? Do you just try to defend yourself? How do you develop this community? And it's kind of an interesting tale of, you know, two perspectives on that. I don't think this is a perfect movie. I had little bits and pieces of things I didn't think worked performance wise, and some of the editing was a bit wonky for me. But the story is so compelling that I was always in it, and I think it's definitely worth a watch. So I wanted to recommend Defiance because I saw it for the first time.
Yeah, I saw this a while. I mean, I saw it when it came out. I don't think I was fully familiar with Daniel Craig, even though, like, he'd been in things before, but I had not, like, fully, like, let him enter my body yet. Mm-hmm. If I'm saying
sure,
that right.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm becoming more and more like Tobias Funk every day. Funke every day. I've decided. But yeah, I haven't seen it in forever. I don't remember much about it, but I feel like I had the same opinion as you did mm-hmm. back then. Because one of those where it like feels like it should be great. And it's not fully great. So, yeah.
It's such a great story. And it has that going for it, if nothing else. By the way, I didn't mention Liev Schreiber is the other brother. And they're kind of working two different, perspectives on this whole thing. So, I'd check it out. I think it's worth a watch for the story alone. And it's done well. So, yeah, that's Defiance.
I went to the theaters over the past week, and I had been hearing a lot of good buzz about The Wild Robot, so I went ahead and watched that. And currently, with an 8.5, I believe, on the IMDb, which is a little bit weighted to the fact that it's just come out, but that's going to have a lasting rating, I have a feeling. But having watched it now, I see what everybody's saying. It's funny. How is it that we've made so many great cartoons involving robots over the years. Big Hero 6, WALL-E, you know, these type of movies. Like
Iron Giant.
Yeah. What is the deal? What is the deal with robot movies? There's something about them, this one focuses on a robot that has fallen out of a plane or a crash landing or something like that on an island somewhere, and it's a helper robot thing, and basically what it's supposed to do is, like, it takes somebody's task and then it finishes the task, and that's basically what it's made for. So this robot is out in the middle of nowhere, and it's basically going around asking all the animals what it wants, what they want, and of course doesn't know how to speak the language of all the animals, and the animals don't know what it wants, and they think it's just a monster. And so eventually some events occur where the robot has to take care of a baby goose. Now the robot is voiced by Lupita Nyong'o, and it's a great question. Of course it's great. I mean, she's probably in my current top five right now of actors.
Yes, season tickets for Lupita for sure. Like, anything she's doing, I'm paying attention.
Yeah, I just love her. She happens upon a baby goose who the goose very quickly thinks that the robot is her mom, is its mom. And the robot, not programmed for these tasks, is now sort of being forced to learn what it means to be a mom and change its programming. And the whole movie is about motherhood and possibly unwanted motherhood as well. It is delightful from beginning to finish. This is a really, really good movie. There's a fox that is voiced by an unrecognizable Pedro Pascal. You do not know that. I was sitting there going, who is this? I was running the gamut of voices that in my head, and I could not come up with Pedro Pascal. This is a phenomenal movie, and it's a mid-level hit. I don't think it's like a Pixar level type of thing, but it really should be. And I think it's probably a shoe-in for an animated Oscar nominee, and it may not have any chance against Inside Out 2, but I like it better than Inside Out 2. So that's the way
I wouldn't count it out from everything that I'm hearing. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, and I have been assured by no less than four people who know me well that this is my kind of movie.
It really is.
So I'm excited to finally see it. I actually had planned on seeing it here in the UK, which you might hear in the outtakes because we talked about it before the show, but and forgot totally that release schedules are completely different across the world. so it's not out here yet. But I'm excited to see it.
And there's a comment that Castor says, I think it is Pixar level. I think it is Pixar level quality. I don't think it's making Pixar level dollars. It's making a lot of money, but not like to the level of like an Inside Out 2, which over the summer was, I think, the number two movie?
Number one.
It was number one. Number one.
Yeah, so, beat Deadpool and Wolverine even. Yeah, it made over $700 million
Deadpool
domestic.
I thought Deadpool and Wolverine may have passed it, but okay, Inside Out 2.
It might have by now, but at the end of the summer, it was definitely still ahead. So, yeah.
All right.
My number two is, let's just classify it as a sporting event. Now, I'm going to throw the Welcome to Wrexham graphic up here because this is my... This is my inlet into what I'm going to recommend here, which is if you ever find yourself in the UK for any amount of time, I'm going to highly recommend you get yourself to a local football stadium / soccer and be in person for a match. It's insane. Now, I've been to plenty of sporting matches in my life. I've seen my favorite teams play in the playoffs of most of the major sports. And I love those experiences, and there's something about rooting on your team in a championship run that's hard to top. But I found my way into the team in Wrexham through the show Welcome to Wrexham, and through Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney buying this tiny little team in Wales, Wrexham Wales, and then just watching them kind of grow over the last three seasons be promoted twice in 2 years and now going for their, you know, third promotion in 3 years. And if you don't know what about promotion and relegation, I think I've talked about that in the outtakes maybe at one point or another, because it's one of my favorite mm-hmm. things about the EFL, which is the English yeah. Football League, is the idea that every tiny town has a football team. And if it goes right, that team can get all the way to the top. It just, you have to win league and get up to the next league and then up to the next league.
Is that different from Premier League? I thought Premier League did that too.
That is Premier League is the top rung of the EFL.
Okay, so it's called the EFL broadly mm-hmm. and Premier yes. is a subset
is the
of
top.
That. Okay.
Right, so it goes Premier, Championship, League One, League Two.
Okay.
And Wrexham has made it all the way up to League One this year. So if they get promoted again, they're just one below the Premier League at that point. So it's been really fun to watch them. I've developed a rooting interest, which it's weird to find fandom, you know, kind of later in life. But it's, you know, it's a fun thing. But I went to a game, went to a Wrexham game, got the scarf. And I think one of the things I was most impressed by is the chanting. I just don't mm-hmm. think we have anything like it in American sports, where every player has a different song or chant mm-hmm. that when they do something good, the entire stadium knows the tune, knows the words, and does the chant together. And it is something really interesting and powerful about it. Mm-hmm. I should say everybody but the one section that's the opposing fans, which that's the other thing about going to a European soccer match, is they section off yeah. the fans from the other team. So the other team had one goal, and just to see like one little section of the entire stadium go crazy was kind of interesting too. But mm-hmm. Wrexham won 4-1. It was a blast to watch. We were like row four behind Wrexham's first half goal. Mm-hmm. So we got to see two goals really close up. It's really amazing to watch the talent and then think this is the talent two levels down from the Premier League. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience and I highly recommend it. If you're not a sports person, I get it. Mm-hmm. But if you are a sports person, even if you don't have a rooting interest, it's a unique, special experience and I'd highly recommend it.
I've been to a couple of professional soccer matches. I don't know how, you know, like, here in the U.S., the U.S. League is probably considered way down. Like, it might even be below the level that you saw.
Right.
And everything. But that hasn't prevented some U.S. teams from trying to, you know, hawk some players from Europe. And so I've been to a couple here for Nashville's team, and I got to see them play the LA Galaxy once, and I also saw them play Miami with Lionel Messi on the team. And,
nice.
And Messi has I think he's come to Nashville twice, and if you're a Messi fan, he has never disappointed. He's always scored a goal, I believe, in both of those games. But it is a whole lot of fun, and even in the U.S. soccer, you get chants, you get a lot of chants and stuff. And I would credit a lot of people from other countries for starting those chants, because it ain't us, you know. It ain't like it's not the locals who are doing that. But it's always fun. It's always fun to hear those. Like we're watching. The first game that I ever went to, I've been to four games now. There was one we went to where it was like we were directly behind the chanting section, and it was just a whole lot of fun. So
it is. Yeah. Somebody in the chat mentioned, you know, some American chants, and then somebody said, yeah, but in the U.S., it's the teams piping something through the speakers, you know, that start those chants. It's so different and I don't mean soccer wise. Like, I don't know how soccer works in the U.S. It may be very similar.
Yeah, in the U.S., they're organic. They're not coming through the speakers.
That's the beautiful thing is, like, there is nobody playing anything through any speakers at this mm-hmm. match. And it's the fans are in it. They don't need somebody telling them when to chant defense. You know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. it's I don't know. It's really fascinating, and I had a really good time. So I wanted
yeah.
to.
I will if I finally make it back out that way, I will definitely go see a match. I was not on board with that type of thing. Well, I probably wasn't. I probably didn't have time 30 years ago because I was in a one of these when we went to Europe 30 years ago. It was like this very rigid, have to go see this and this and this and this, and very little free time to go do your own thing. Yeah. So I'd like to go back as an adult and do whatever I damn well please.
exactly.
Yes. My last small recommend is Deep Red from 1975. I have sort of gotten a giallo bug. I don't know if I'm going to keep watching these things over the few weeks, but this is Dario Argento, and Dario Argento is probably like the dean of this genre. I was talking about, you know, the Blood and Black Lace movie last week and how like everything is super heightened and everything. And in this one, like, look in the background of a Dario Argento movie and it's like everything looks just empty. But if there are people in the background, they're not doing anything. They're just kind of sitting there as if in a painting, and it sort of adds to the like eeriness and creepiness of everything that you're watching, because look in the background, everybody's just kind of just sitting still, not doing anything. This one stars David Wenham, I think it's Wenham, David Hemmings, who some of you may know from Blow Up. That's one of the big movies he's in. He's also in Gladiator, but he looks so different in Gladiator that I can't remember what character that was that he played, but I saw some pictures and I was like, yeah, he was the guy who whatever. Anyway, this one is about a psychic who sort of predicts her own death, and she feels a presence around her as she's going around doing demonstrations and everything. And on the night that she does get murdered, our main character, played by David Hemmings, witnesses it. And as one does, he goes to run to try to save her, and she's long dead by the time he gets there. But he feels like he noticed something when he was running through the room to try to save her that's not there anymore. And he's telling the cops, like, I feel like there was a painting here that was here, and I don't know where it is now. Do you guys take evidence away? And the cops said, no, we don't take anything out of here and all that stuff. And this is enough for him to go on his own investigation as he gets very curious about it. And this is one of those movies that I definitely don't want to tell you too much about, because it is a murder mystery and everything, and the things that he goes and does and whatever is a part of the surprise and fun of it. But Dario Argento movies are like nothing else. If you've ever seen the original Suspiria, you know what I'm talking about. It's just one of those. It's just enjoy the visuals, enjoy the nuttiness of everything that's going on, like stuff that is done very crazy things that are happening are done very straight. So like, you know, just enjoy the tapestry that Argento creates for you, and enjoy the horror and the mystery. So there you go.
I might someday enjoy the horror in the mystery, Chris. Who knows? I'm not opposed. I'm not scared to watch a movie like this. It just doesn't. I don't usually come away from them thinking, oh, that was a good, you know, choice for my 2 hours of the day or whatever. But honestly, the older I get, the more open I am to seeing movies for what they intend to be, whether they impact me directly or not. You know what I mean? Like to be able to go. Like to take a movie on the playing field that it's operating on rather than the one I would like it to operate on. So I wouldn't be surprised if I watch some Argento down the road. So
yeah. I mean, it's fully completely different from your average everyday horror movie. And that's why it gets a good shove from me. Like, hey, take a look at this. It's a little bit more artful than your typical horror movie. So there you go. All right, on to our big recommend, which is Pitch Black, and it's Aaron's. So Aaron, take us away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Pitch Black is the 2000 David Toohey follow-up to 1996 Arrival. They don't really have anything to do with each other. I just wanted to mention that movie. We start this movie in true Star Wars fashion by checking out the underside of a slow-moving space vehicle as Vin Diesel narrates us on how the brain works during cryosleep. He begins to exposition us on all the other people in cryosleep with him, including how he can smell the boot sweat of females. I said boot sweat, just to be clear.
Right.
Some meteors pierce the ship and use their captain homing story device to make sure Captain Tom is dead and the other crew are awakened in time to try to save the rest of them by crash landing on the nearest planet. Fry, played by Radha Mitchell, shows her expertise as Owens plays the jerk foil who is just there to complain about her doing the best that she can and also trying to eject the passengers. They eventually crash through some warped visuals, some eyeball close-ups, and the entire back of the airship falls off cliche. Cut to Johns. He is on board as a maybe a police officer, somebody who's taking care of Riddick. And he's searching the wreckage for the prisoner formerly known as Vin Diesel. But for this movie, we will call him Riddick because that's his name. They then find Owens with some deserved rebar through his chest. And after realizing he's still alive, the survivors meet outside in the apparently clean atmosphere to try to figure out what's going on. The survivors check on their stowed luggage, and Vin dislocates his shoulders so he can use the convenient break in the girder and convenient nearby tools to start his next convenient escape. The crew then congregates for a full "you better come and take a look at this and fry your corneas" cliche to be the most important instance ever of something having three sons since Fred McMurray settled for a TV show in the 1960s.
Da-da-da-da.
You got it. Our crew is now the aforementioned Fry and Johns with Abu Imam al-Walid, played by the ever-welcome Keith David, a Muslim preacher guiding three young pilgrims to New Mecca, a teenager named Jack, a pair of prospectors named Shaza and Zeke, and a rich merchant named Paris. The Amon group heads off with Fry and Johns to find Riddick, but instead finds a settlement with a possible water source and transport. Back at the ship, the rest of the group are jump-scared by a survivor. Scratch that. A former survivor who just got mistakenly shot by Zeke, so we wouldn't feel so bad when he's the next to go. After a hilarious zoom in Riddick enhance cliche, Zeke goes out exploring the desert holes, as one does, until he gets dragged away by something. Of course, the crew blames Riddick, and he's back in chains again, long enough to do a little exposition on how he got those night vision peepers. He convinces Fry that he didn't kill Zeke and that it was something else, and she confirms it by deciding to go alone into a nest of some scary-looking creatures that got Zeke and almost got her twice. Now that Johns knows what they're up against, he lets Riddick go, and when Riddick gets the jump on him, he gives him back his gun, you know, as a sign of trust. The crew finally gets back to the ship, and just when they think that everything might be okay, Ali walks off and finds some scary bats, but instead of becoming Batman, he just follows them into a darker room so he can be eaten. Now that the group knows that their new ship is right on top of a death den, they start trying to figure out the mystery. Fry then conveniently finds that the last core samples are from 22 years ago, which conveniently makes her check the convenient Eclipse planning model, and they all realize it's about to get very dark soon. Meanwhile, Riddick notices that Johns is a morphine addict when he sees Johns getting sick and shaking during Riddick's normal molasses head shaving routine. Riddick then passes this info on to Fry in about the creepiest way possible so that she can catch him with a needle in his eye later and call him on the carpet just before the eclipse ticking clock kicks in full force with a Saturn-like planet appearing on the horizon. The crew is now in a mad dash to get the fuel sources for their new ship, and uh-oh, the eclipse is starting and the bats are back, and they are hungry for anyone who dares to stand up, which Shaza does and is promptly torn asunder. The crew hides in the wreckage, but it only lasts so long as some of the Noluxosaurs, yeah, I made that up because Bioraptors is dumb, have made their way in and take out one another at another one of the Imam's pilgrims. They also manage to kill one by shining some light on it to confirm that light is indeed their friend. Fry then suggests that because Riddick can see in the dark, he should be the one to lead them through the desert. You know, like a traveling fiber optic rave they've got going on. Paris decides to run away from the group and pays the price by wishing he were in France. Oh, and also getting torn apart by the Tenebriosauruses. Riddick then realizes that Jack is actually a woman whose menstruation is drawing the creatures to them, which is a realization that happens just in time for the big third act conflict cliche. Johns comes up with the idea to drag a body behind them and privately suggests that Riddick kill the girl, while Riddick thinks maybe they need a piece of bigger bait. The two face off, and you'll never believe this, Riddick wins. Riddick then offers to drag the power cells back himself if the others will run ahead of him so they can all get back to the escape vehicle. As they're running, they are shocked by some sticky turquoise rain, but when they look up, they realize it's actually the creatures killing each other, and the liquid is the most important instance of blue blood since Tom Selleck settled for a TV show in the 2010s. And if all of this weren't enough, it starts raining regular water rain and putting out the torches they've been using for defense. Riddick tells them to stay in the cave, and he heads to the ship alone. Fry doesn't trust Riddick, so she uses some bioluminescence in a bottle to make the final part of the trip while the Amon and Jack wait to see if somebody will come back for them. She arrives just in time to have a heart-to-heart with Riddick about whether they should go back and save the other two. He tries to convince her to join him on the ship, but she flashes back to her choice to eject them earlier and realizes, huh, I do actually care about other people's lives. That determination convinces Riddick to go back with her, and they all run back to the ship. Riddick gets left behind for some one-on-one blind spot dancing with the dark dragons, but when another one tries to cut in, we cut away from the good stuff so that we can instead have him stumble back to the ship and get Fry killed instead. On the ship, Riddick, Jack, and the Amon are ready to take off before Riddick kills the engines just to bait a few more of the night noggins around for a proper bedtime story. And that is Pitch Black. Chris, what did you think this time through?
I've always enjoyed this movie. It was a surprise to me that I enjoyed it when it first came out. We send this movie. I don't remember too much about what we send in this. As I was watching it, I was like, what did we say about this? I didn't go back to go and check or anything. But anyway, I enjoyed this again, this time. And I think part of it is, I think Vin Diesel is way more likable back in this era. I don't know what it is that changed. Maybe nothing changed. I don't know. Something definitely feels like it changed between this and the Fast and the Furious movies, and then his hiatus from the Fast and the Furious movies, and then his comeback to them. And it feels like he's just way more serious as an actor. I know he does the I Am Groot, but come on, that's just a little voice thing he does, and they probably modulate it several times. He only has to say it like a few times, and then takes a paycheck and goes on. I'm talking about his actual live action things when he's in there. It feels like he takes himself a little bit too seriously these days. And this is a character he does not. Riddick is smarter and he's more fun to watch. I love the morally ambiguous character who can change his motivations on a dime. We never really kind of, you know, he seems like, okay, at first, total bad guy is what we first think. And then we're like, oh, well, maybe he's not as bad as we think. And then later on, it's like, oh, well, he's going to kind of do what he wants to do in the given moment that will help him along, whatever will help him along the most. So I love that kind of character. We don't get to see that very often. As a side note, I do love Cole Hauser versus Vin Diesel. In the battle of one guy who was in a Fast and the Furious movie that Vin Diesel was not in, and then Vin Diesel, who is basically the face of the Fast and Furious franchise. I do like the plotting here. I think it's There is, of course, a highly ridiculous thing here, but this is the reason why we make movies, right? I mean, we would send this in a sins video, but the fact that they just happen to crash on a planet that just happens to have three suns that just so happens to be having an eclipse, and they just so happen to have creatures that come out during the dark. And I know we can break that down completely because, you know, like, how do these creatures survive for however long it is underneath the, do they just eat each other? Do they have refrigeration? What is it do they have down there that allows them to exist for 22 years? When you get past the like improbabilities of it, I do like how the plot sets up. I do like the fact that there's a part in there where they're like, we need to get the fuel cells for the ship. And the thought is we shouldn't get them right away because Vin Diesel, you know, he escaped using a ship, and he hijacked the ship, and he killed the pilot and all that. So that decision leads to the eclipse happening too soon for them. And I just like how everything is lined up. It's very it's simple. It's not a very complex plot, but sometimes these movies don't get these things right. And I feel like this one does. So I love the moment when it does turn pitch black. I like that a lot, when it's just light out and then it becomes dark and then all those creatures shoot out of from under the ground. I thought that was cool. I love the moment when Paris says, I was supposed to die in France and I never saw France. And then we see the light die out and we see all those creatures around him. Great scene. I love the editing in this movie. You can tell this movie is from 2000 for a variety of reasons, because it's the way it's presented, way it's edited, the way it's shot. That era of 2000 to 2003-ish, around that era, all have the same kind of like, it's still MTV, but it's like an MTV on steroids type of thing going on. I like, there's scenes where people are running and it'll jump cut as they go, and it sort of makes it move faster. I love that scene when the dude that they accidentally shoot is walking towards them and they're all inside and they see the light turn into shadow, and then it shows their eyes again, and then it goes to another spot and there's another light that turns into shadow, and it does it very quickly, but it's not obnoxious. I don't feel like it's ever obnoxious in this. And all you have to do is look at another Vin Diesel movie called Triple X and you'll find the obnoxious editing in that movie. Now you said rebar. Now I may have a different interpretation. I thought it was a handle that went through Owen's.
It could have been. I could have just misseen it. Yeah, I think you're probably right.
And when he says don't touch the handle, it's a double meaning, because he's been telling her to touch the handle to eject the passengers the entire time. But now this is the irony of the scene, because he told her not to do that, now he's dying by handle. I thought that was cool. And of course, Johns picks up on it later on and says, what did he mean by that? He didn't, he seemed to know that it didn't have anything to do with the thing that was sticking out of him at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jack, who is revealed to be a girl by the end, tells Fry, thanks for saving our dicks. And and I think there's a little bit of foreshadowing there, but I also think it could mean that many of the passengers are dicks. Like if you take a look at it that way, thanks for saving our dicks. You know, they're dicks, but there are dicks, you know. I feel like most of the people on this excursion are dickish. There's a lot of dickitude going on this ship. So I don't know if that was as far as he wanted to take that, or it was just a fun line for them to say, but I thought that was fun. Love when Riddick says to Johns, I told you should have ghosted me, when Johns is looking for him in the dark and can't see him. And then the funny line for me, and this is another thing, this is a testament to why Vin Diesel became a star to me. We just don't see this anymore. When he beats up that, or he kills that whatever you called them. I don't remember what you called them.
Several things.
The tetrahedrons. When he killed one of those aliens, or whatever, when he after he kills him, he's like, did not know who he was fucking with. I just, it kills me. He doesn't say he did not know who he was fucking with. He just says, did not know who he was fucking with. And I just enjoy that on a very simple level on this movie. So, yeah, in the end, is Pitch Black a great movie? No. Is it a terrible movie? Of course not. It is a perfect, like, but it is a perfect, like, action horror thriller type movie. It really does fit the bill. I'm glad you chose this because these are the type of movies that we forget about. And I, and they went on to make more Riddick movies after this. And I feel like they expanded the universe so much in those that I was like, but I like the down home, like stripped down Riddick story, not these giant space opera things that he got into later. So there you go. That's what I think about Pitch Black. I think it's a very, very well-made movie.
Yeah, it sounds like our opinions are very similar. In fact, you mentioned a lot of the same things I wanted to mention, chief among them, how compelling and endearing even Vin Diesel is in this movie, even as, like, you know, this tough guy killer, he has this, this calm, magnetism to him that, you know, that I think he would extend to parody very quickly in his career, unfortunately. But here it just works for me. You mentioned one of those great lines. I think there are two other examples of this where I can't see him with this good a delivery in future movies. One was he says it looks clear, and then they, you know, look up and there's something there, and the guy says, I thought you said it was clear. And he said, I said it looks clear. And the guy says, well, how's it look now? And he goes, looks clear.
That's all you can, that's basically saying that's all you can ask for in this situation.
Yeah.
You don't have you don't have a heat map of anything.
Right.
You have to go on faith sometime.
And the delivery is just, it's a great line read. It's a really great line read on that. Looks clear. You know, like, what else am I supposed to say here? Is so good. And then the other one is when John's is talking about killing people, and he said, it's called triage. And Vin Diesel responds, they kept calling it murder when I did it. You know, just the delivery on that is yeah, so good too. And there's just those examples in this movie. And it is kind of the 1-2 punch of Tui's writing, which, if you haven't seen The Arrival, I mean, every movie fan has to watch The Arrival at some point, right? Like, it could by all means be a terrible movie, you know, like with some of the things it's doing and some of the weirdness in that movie. But Tui does have a really interesting sense of humor, and there are some, you know, really funny lines in The Arrival as well. That I think we see here too. So it's the 1-2 punch of the writing and then also Vin Diesel's delivery, I think, on those lines is really, really good. Another place where I see his charisma coming across is in his relationship with Jack, which is kind of a nothing relationship in the movie, other than Jack starts to emulate him in many ways, you know, shaving the head, you know, making up their own goggles, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's really kind of sweet, and the movie lets it be kind of sweet.
It really is.
And so all that stuff, I think, works too.
Well, and there's that point too where Jack says, I don't think he's coming back, when they're in the cave. And he isn't. He's ready to strap up and go.
He's gone.
And it's only because Fry shows up that he even comes back. But he pulls the stone aside, and Jack says, never had a doubt. You know, it's just so,
so good. It is so good. Great delivery on that too. You mentioned a lot of the editing choices, which I also like. The movie isn't afraid just to be bold with the choices it's making. There's one shot. It's like a super wide angle when they're walking across the desert where it looks like they're walking like a slope because of the wide angle camera.
Yeah.
It's a really evocative shot. And the movie just isn't afraid to play in those spaces. I'm not sure I'm totally on board with the color grading in this movie and the coloring choices. It's a bit strange for me, but again, it's a bold choice.
It's an alien world.
Yeah, and it might work for some people. Mm. There's a shot through a drop of water when they find the first drop of water from the well coming up that's really cool and inventive and fun. And you mentioned possibly the best shot of the movie, which is when he takes a swig of alcohol right before he dies and then blows it into his lighter.
Yeah.
And the flame just flames out, and you just see that he is surrounded by dozens of these creatures as far as he can see.
Yeah.
And then it cuts away. It's a really, really cool, evocative way to show that. So yeah, there's just a lot of really good stuff in here. I'm not sure the philosophical stuff is explored enough to really give the movie a ton of credit for it.
Yeah.
But it's there. And I think the movie is trying to say something, about nihilism versus faith with the Amon character and the Vin Diesel character. But I think it's trying to give an honest, differing perspective. Like, I don't think we're supposed to think, Riddick believes in God now. Like, I don't think that's where we end, but it does allow the Amon to say, cause Riddick, you know, says, "Where is your God?" You know, several times through this mess is, you know, like terrible things happen. It starts raining on their torches or whatever. And then the Amon, when he comes back to rescue him, says, you know, "This is where my God is." Mm-hmm. Basically, I think the idea being like, my God is in love, like changed hearts. Like, you know, God is in the making choices for fellow human beings.
Well, you know, and also, you know, by the end of it, you can say that he's the only... Well, maybe I'm probably saying something that's already contradictory now that I think about it.
No, go for it.
His pilgrims die, but he's one of these, of all the characters that you get to know in this, is the only like pure of heart one in this one. It feels like, I don't think there's anything he does in this that you could say, oh, that was a bad moral choice or whatever. Mm-hmm. Everybody in this movie has a bad moral choice that they make that, you know, there's some that are obvious, and then there are others like Fry, who, you know, she is trying to save herself, but she thinks that it's almost an opposite of the trolley problem, kind of thing.
Sure.
Like, do I save just me and my co-pilot, or, or do I allow everybody to die if I don't get this thing to go back up? And it takes, you know, because she becomes the sort of the 1B main character of the movie. Of course, she lasts all the way until the end, but everybody's got those moral choices. And I think Iman like ends up being the one that's of pure of heart. And because he doesn't have any secondary like motivations or tries to antagonize anybody, he does get saved in the end. Now, it does require Fry to do that, but you could also say Iman's actions get Fry, or Iman's belief in God gets Fry to come out and draw Riddick back to him and everything. So there are things in there, but you're right, it's not explored enough. I think like you might be approaching greatness if you can study those a little bit more.
Yeah, it's almost as if the movie has so many things it wants to do that it lacks a little bit of focus on, you know, what is the main thing? Like, what is the main point that it wants to make? I actually think the script is written so that is the main point is when it gets dark, let's say that metaphorically, even, you know, as opposed to literally in this movie, when it gets dark, what does your belief system have to do with how you react, right? Yeah. I think that's what the movie is trying, because we start off with her making a choice, you know, things got rough and she has a choice put in front of her right at the beginning. So to bookend that with what's happening at the end, and then to have him in his conversation with the Imam, like that to me really seems like the script's main focus could have been the idea of, okay, Some people, when it gets dark, act to out of survival for themselves. Other people, when it gets dark, act out of survival for the community or for all of us. And but again, it has so much else it wants to do that it doesn't really get a chance to sink into that in a way that would make this movie great. So
and if that was a part of the original idea, then I'm almost certain the studio came in and said, "No, we're going to cut this down to an hour and 45 minutes, and you know we can't have a 2-hour movie with a guy we've never seen before as the main star." Apparently this was supposed to be a Steven Seagal movie at one point. In my efforts to find the actual David Tui pronunciation, I ran across an interview where apparently Seagal was going to be the guy because they needed a name actor to play Riddick. And it almost didn't happen, I think, because he didn't want Seagal, but I guess Vin Diesel impressed him enough to finally get it and get it made. But probably if you get Vin Diesel, you have to make sacrifices on the other end where you're like, well, now your budget's less and now you're going to have to do it by our rules. So,
yeah. Cause Keith David was probably easily the most known name of all of them. And it's not like Keith David was necessarily a household name among non-movie lovers, you know?
Yeah. And Radha Mitchell, you've seen her a million times, but you probably don't even know her name sometimes. Mm-hmm. I was even sitting there like, cause she and Saffron Burroughs used to kind of like go back and forth on these type of movies. And I was like, oh yeah, Radha Mitchell, she was in Deep Blue Sea. And then I had to correct myself. Nope. That was Saffron Burroughs, and they all had the same kind of the career. It feels like so. I think Keith David was probably the biggest known actor in that movie.
I mean, maybe Cole Hauser.
Nobody really knew his name either. But Cole Hauser's fascinating to me because he is okay. So in Dazed and Confused, almost everybody in that movie is like we see, all high school movies. They're in their early 20s or something like that. Cole Hauser is actually 17, I think, in that movie, and he looks older than everybody else. He looks older than Vin Diesel does in this movie, but he is 8 years younger than Vin Diesel in Pitch Black. So like he's fascinating to me. He's had a pretty interesting career. He was in Good Will Hunting and all that, but he's an interesting guy to me. All right.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Hi, podcast listeners. Danae here, and I want to tell you about Mint Mobile because they saved me money, and I appreciate that. Mint Mobile also made it easy to save money on my phone plan. So here's how it works. Here's how to get great wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of their 3-month plan. You go to mintmobile.com/recotopia, and you're going to see all of their plans. And right now, all of the 3-month plans are just $15 a month, and that includes the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your number along with all of your existing contacts. And that's it. That's how easy it is. Just you go and you look at the information. You're like, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? The hardest part is just deciding to break up with your current phone people. To get this new customer offer and your 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That is mintmobile.com/recotopia, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. Heads up, $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to the $15 a month, and new customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This message comes from BetterHelp. Can you think of a time when you didn't feel like you could be yourself, like you were hiding behind a mask? BetterHelp online therapy is convenient, flexible, and can help you learn to be your authentic self so you can stop hiding. Because masks should be for Halloween fun, not for your emotions. Take off the mask with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
So this one's very, 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 very simple. I tried to think along the lines at first because I feel like I had seen movies before where your anti-hero is the guy who knows everything, and I'm sure I've seen many movies like that. I just couldn't think of those movies. I couldn't think of them in the time that I had. I was sitting there trying to think of movies where there's characters like Vin Diesel in this who are prisoners, but they're the ones who have basically all the answers, or they're smarter. They're the smartest people in the room and everything. So I skipped over that a little bit. And then I thought about the environment that we're in here. How many movies have this unique feature of this is a planet where at some certain point, everything goes dark, every 22 years or whatever the cycle is and everything. And it creates a problem, a unique problem to that place. And it's a very simple super secret double feature. It's 30 Days of Night, which, has, you know, it's set in Alaska. So it's, you know, it's got that 6 months of dark, or it's got a month of darkness, I guess, a month of darkness in this movie. I think it's Alaska that they're in, and then vampires show up. And so that's, there's no daylight that's coming for these 30 days. I felt like that was a perfect kind of, a compliment to this. 30 Days of Night was I believe a comic book, before this was, or a graphic novel before it became a movie. I don't know which came out first, the comic book of 30 Days of Night before Pitch Black or what, but anyway, those movies would be perfect complements to each other. I think you got Josh Hartnett, who's having kind of a renaissance, of his own, playing in this one. I have not seen 30 Days of Night in forever though. And I remember kind of liking it, kind of like Pitch Black, kind of enjoyed it, on the same level, back then.
Nice.
And just as a quick note too, I read that Pitch Black was David Toohey's, branched off of David Toohey's idea for Alien 3 that was not used.
Oh,
so okay. Apparently he, I don't know if he was in, if he's credited on Alien 3 anywhere, but this was apparently his, I don't know how much has changed from Alien, his original idea of what Alien 3 would be, but apparently this was, based off of that. So that was, an interesting thing because it does have very alien like, tendencies, throughout. But, anyway,
it was,
that's, yeah,
it was interesting. Looking at, because I, you know, pulled up his IMDb or whatever and looking at Toohey's career, like he wrote some like classic, like some really good movies that he didn't direct. And then Pitch Black, I think, was the only one. I mean, like I mentioned, The Arrival is worth a watch just to be in awe of it. But Pitch Black is the only one of his I love. But like, I wish I could remember, but he wrote on several really good movies there in a row, between The Arrival and Pitch Black, actually. So, yeah, he's a good writer.
Yeah, I believe his first one was The Fugitive, and
yes,
yeah, and then he had, I can't remember. I remember reading over his writing resume, and I was like, okay, this feels very Akiva Goldsman like, where like he had one big hit, and then all the movies after that he. And you never know with these. That's the problem with screenwriters. You never know unless they're like a star screenwriter, like an Aaron Sorkin or somebody like that, how much has been changed since they wrote the screenplay. So a lot of times they're hired to write the screenplay, and then the director and everybody else comes in and says, oh, that's pretty good. Let's rip all these pages out, and let's put all this stuff in. And we don't know if the screenwriter is actually a part of the badness of the movie that we saw.
So. I'd like to take back my thoughts that he wrote several. The Fugitive was the one that I thought of. I like Waterworld more than most, but he wrote.
Oh yeah, Waterworld.
Waterworld was one of the other ones that he wrote, and then Terminal Velocity, which that makes sense. That makes complete sense.
I mean, he's worked with Charlie Sheen a couple of times. It's Terminal Velocity. Terminal Velocity came out before The Arrival, I believe.
Yeah, 2 years before The Arrival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, yeah. Talk about a movie that's insane is Terminal Velocity.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, The Arrival, not to be confused with just Arrival that Denis Villeneuve made, but
yeah,
The Arrival, the one from 1996, that is a fascinating, that's one that should probably be a big recommend someday.
It's wild.
Get a dissection of some sort. So,
and then of all things, G.I. Jane. He wrote G.I. Jane as well. So,
yeah, and Eights mentions A Perfect Getaway, which is one of the,
sure,
is a fantastic movie, by the way. Fantastic. I was completely surprised by that one when it came out. Okay, on to the homework for next week, which again we are going to be doing Monday at the same time as we did today. I want to pull out some bangers, and so we're going to do The Thing from 1982 once again. John Carpenter rearing his ugly head on our program. But this is a banger. I was thinking about another movie. I don't know. Okay. This movie may be grosser than that movie that I'm not doing right now. But mm-hmm. I think people will be able to swallow it more. Again, I'm becoming Tobias Funke right in front of our eyes. Swallow this more than the other one. The other one that I'm thinking of, and I'm not going to reveal it yet because I may still do it. That one, the violence in the one that I'm thinking of is more real. It's like, it's more, it like hits you a little bit more. Whereas The Thing is kind of like very fantastical gore and violence and things like that. I will warn you, The Thing's got some gross stuff in it. But what a fantastic movie this is. And I can't wait to break it down and talk about it next week. So
I am excited. I'm so very excited. I only recently watched this for the first time. I say recently, within the last 5 years, watched this for the first time. And I think this is one of the greatest movies ever made. I think it's just absolutely breathtaking and compelling. And I am excited to talk about this rocket sled of a movie. It's so good.
Oh, yeah. And it had the unfortunate, I believe, circumstance of coming out in the same summer that E.T. and Poltergeist came out. And it was not well received when it came out. And it was sort of a dead on arrival type movie, if I recall the history correctly on this movie. But ever since then, it has gained a robust crowd of lovers of it. So,
yep.
So I can't wait to go over that one again. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you guys for coming out, and especially on a different day and a different time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming out. We'll be doing it again the same time next week, and we'll be doing The Thing. Can't wait to do that. So that's going to be it for today. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. His setup, yep. as we refer to it derisively.
Ian just gave me a pork pie.
Yeah,
you know a pork pie. You know what a pork pie is?
I don't.
So it's just a little piece of sausage that's in like a some sort of pastry, but it's not like pigs in a blanket pastry. It's more like I don't know how to explain it, but it's just this little, like, bite-sized little nummy-num.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, oh, well, that's something we could have in America, and I'd be fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but no.
Well, I'm wondering why we don't have it here if it's good. So you're saying it's delightful, these pork pies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice little like snack, and it's a little bit of carbs, a little bit of protein, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Yeah. Better than a Snickers bar.
Mm. Might have one of those afterwards.
Unless they want to advertise with us, in which case Snickers bar.
Snickers would be the most are satisfying. Amazing. Yeah. Second to none. The one.
So I'm learning all the UK cuisine, all the English things.
Mm-hmm.
Every restaurant has meat pies, which is different than a pork pie, but like a steak and ale, or like a chicken and leek, or a chicken and mushroom. And we would call them pot pies, I think. Like, it's kind of the idea is like a pot pie, but like every restaurant has their version of one.
Hmm.
And they've really got it down. And then they've got these chip shops, which, you know, chips is
fries.
Like fries, but it's more like a steak fry. I guess technically in the UK, the skinny fries are called fries. So like if you go somewhere and they have fries on the menu, it's like a steak and shake fries. You know,
okay.
Like kind of those, what do they call them? Shoestring fries or whatever.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, so they've got these chip shops, they call them chippies or whatever, and they just fry all this stuff in there. The one we went to had, of course, fish and chips, which is, you know, the staple. And then they also had like, I forget what they called it, but it was fried Spam. It was just a circle of fried Spam, you know, that they would give you.
That was, so. I don't know if it was just that. I, you know, ran into a bunch of coincidental stuff, but over like, I don't know, 3-4, maybe longer years ago, I heard a lot of people getting online saying they hated steak fries. Like, and I get it. You like what you like, but it was being grouped in that group of like only things people who have poor taste like, you know, like I'm like, and I was sitting there going, I am a connoisseur of fries. I've had a lot of fries in my day. I prefer the steak fry. I don't know why. It's the texture. It's the way. I mean, I just prefer it. And now there's a bunch of people online who, maybe it's not a bunch of people. Maybe it's just a handful of people. Maybe it was like two people. But like, I'm sitting there going, what is it? Are they just like, I don't like it. And everybody else who likes it, I don't get it. You like the steak fry, right?
Yeah, I dig steak fries. I can't think of a type of French fry that I don't enjoy. Like,
well,
you know,
it's the potato wedges that I don't like. I think that's too much. Like KFC went from fries to potato wedges way back in the day. They may have changed back since. I haven't been to KFC in a while, but they had potato wedges, and I was never a big fan of those because it was just too big of a potato putting in your mouth as far as, like, a side to your chicken or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You could make potato wedges work. They just had to be smaller for me.
Yeah. I think potato wedges sometimes just feel like potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're just eating a part of a potato because they're so thick. But I don't mind them.
No.
Yeah, there's almost no way you could make potatoes unless you put a bunch of stuff in it I don't like. Like if you put some food in the potato that I don't like a baked potato with something in there I don't like.
Yeah.
But potato, man, it's just this beautiful neutral starch taste that I like it.
Yeah.
I dig it.
Mm-hmm.
Fry it up. Stick it in a stew. No,
wait. Yes. Have you been to a movie theater while you've been out there?
No, we were going to go, see something. In fact, I wanted to go see, The Wild Robot. I thought, I'll get over there. And then like the three of us can go see The Wild Robot. Cause I thought Jen would like it. I'd been wanting to see it and it's not open here yet. I totally forgot that the release schedule is different over here than it is, in the US. And so, no, we haven't gone out. I thought, oh, well, because it was a Thursday night. And I was like, well, Joker's opening. Let's go see the, you know, Folie à Deux or whatever and tear that to shreds. And And but here they don't do the Thursday night screenings either. So even though it was opening the same weekend, it didn't come out until Friday. And so it was like, oh, well, let's just stay home and watch something else.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't think I've been to a UK movie theater either, but I remember when I was out there, and this was back in 1995, there were not only the late comers, and I working at a movie theater, I'd seen all of them, but there's also those select few that don't get across to the United States, and you're like, what the hell is that type of movies that are out? So... Yeah,
there's one that I knew about because it was kind of on my awards radar last year, but it just didn't come out last year, which is why am I old? Why are names just leaving my brain? Kate Winslet.
That Lee. One where she's a photographer going around. Yeah. It's like Civil War, only in World War II or something.
Yeah. And maybe it is out in limited release in the U.S. as well, but it's out wide here, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about maybe checking out that one. But there are some that are out here that are just like not out in these states. I mean, it's just different, you know? It's different everywhere.
Yeah, I've seen that trailer a few times. I do envy you not watching trailers. I've grown accustomed to that type of thing and grew up and watching them, and of course working as a movie theater projectionist was forced to watch them and just had the realization that's just part of the movie. But I don't know, as a civilian, since then I have grown very tired of certain trailers. They just keep playing over and over and over again. Speak No Evil was one of them. Good movie attached to it, thank God. But then like Joker 2, oh my God, was on every single thing. And now that they're doing the whole, like, you know, the breakdown of why it failed over the weekend and mainly pointing to the cost of what it was and everything. We keep pointing to the cost and wondering where the money is going a lot of times. Man, there needs to be an investigation into this type of stuff. But like, I wonder if Joker is like mostly marketing costs, because how many trailers did I see? It was every movie that could possibly hold a Joker trailer on it ran that trailer. And the only time I didn't run into one was finally when I watched The Wild Robot, because they would not have put a Joker 2 on that. So
yeah, it's nice not to have all that bouncing around. Even as, because I'm in the theater a lot of times when trailers are going on, but I've usually got my headphones in and I'm listening to a podcast and I've got my head in my phone, so I'm not really seeing or hearing things. But even then, I'll pick up bits and pieces of audio or whatever, and that's annoying enough. I can't imagine going back to, like, I mean, there was a time where I couldn't get enough trailers. Like back when 1080p first started becoming a thing with televisions, and we were on Dish Network at the time, and we had the HD package, and there was a channel that was just called HD Trailers, and it showed all it did was show movie trailers in high definition, and I would just put that thing on and just watch it.
Yeah,
you know, as if that was the greatest thing that had ever been invented. And somewhere around the Star Wars trailer that blew up, for the new one, for J.J. Abrams' first one.
Yeah, Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens trailer, which is a great trailer. Like, it's really well put together, whatever. And I loved that trailer so much. And then when I got to the movie, there were several parts in that trailer that didn't show up in the movie. And I spent the entire movie going, when's this thing going to happen? When's this thing going to happen? And my brain just, and it was at that point I was just like, you know, it's not even about story spoilers for me anymore. It's just like, my brain gets too distracted by trying to put the pieces I saw in this other piece of completely different media meant for a different purpose into, you know, where are they going to be in this movie? And is it going to be as cool in the movie? And I was like, I don't need that distraction. And so, yeah, that was pretty much after that. I was just like, as much as I can, I'm just going to be done with them.
Well, and also these days, trailers are not nearly as good as they used to be. And there's a couple of reasons for that, I think. One, the death of Don LaFontaine sort of changed the way trailers were done. I mean, we still have decent trailer voice guys, but nobody's LaFontaine. And so you had trailers, I believe, that were cut so that he could come on and be like in a world, you know, and all that. Mm-hmm. And those trailers are phenomenal. But even the ones without his voice on it were, it seemed like there was an art to it. There was a way they were, like, 2003, now this became an overused thing, but the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was not that was the remake, wasn't a good movie. But the trailer got a lot of buzz because it was doing that thing where it was like people were running and then it would, like, there'd be a snapshot that would pause it and it'd be like this, sound and everything, and that guy who was cutting those trailers was cutting a lot of trailers, and like a lot of them started doing that after a while, and that might be the last part of it, the last glory days of trailers. I don't think there's much of an art to it anymore. The trailers still feel like trailers. It's just that there's something missing. There's a art to it that's missing, I think. There's so many I'd love to just like, I actually love watching the trailers, like as you know, mm-hmm. even if they're bad movies or whatever. That Dark City trailer is one of the best ones of all time. And a lot of it is because the music that they chose was perfect and it goes along with the editing so well. So it's a lot of times there's a little bit more, I don't know. There's more facade to it than actually great trailer, but Dark City trailer, the Strange Days trailer, just I just could play those on repeat.